Pat Schoondell here, and I think I may have hit the lowest point of my life. I've returned from DC, penniless, petulant, and wondering why I continue pressing forward. You see, the only reason I came to this so-called chocolate city, I assure you there was no chocolate that I saw, was because I was promised a sizable stipend from Mark Sarvis, that Bolshevik interloper behind the Lit Blog Co-op. I was asked to attend a party at the Big Hunt, where Mr. Sarvis ducked this simple request at every opportunity. There was a lovely man named Richard, who I got many people to hug, and an even lovelier man named Matt Cheney, who looked as if he needed a kiss. You see, Jorge taught me a few things when we went to the Mojave Desert, things that were inserted into the agreement penned by Mr. Sarvis that I, as a professional, was under every obligation to live up to. I was then given a drink by another lit blogger named Sarah Weinman. Little did I know that this disreputable tart spiked the drink in question. I believe the proper idiom they use on the East Coast is slipped me a Mickey. I then woke up in a large container next to an untamed gorilla whose advances I staved off with bits of banana that had been conveniently placed in my coat pocket. This was only slightly better than my many unfortunate experiences on Southwest Airlines. The plane touched down. I was discovered, and I spent several hours trying to convince the FAA that I was disreputably abandoned by some unknown assailants. They didn't believe me, and they gave me a full-body cavity search. It is only the promise of another paycheck that collects me here. Of course, our young roving correspondent had no such bad experiences. He had no problems whatsoever. He hit the book expo floor, fancying himself some kind of imposter, some literary journalist, and now he has been sifting through hours of audio, trying to find an order, trying to find a meaning, trying to find a I Ching pattern, perhaps a new lease on life. Perhaps you might be better off with that Church of Scientology business, I don't know. Needless to say, the prospect of future appearances remains doubtful, given these considerable calamities. But I suppose our correspondent recorded enough material to keep us occupied for years. This is the first of several podcasts pertaining to our young roving correspondent's work at Book Expo America. As for the gorilla, I've retained a family law attorney to get this business settled once and for all. I do, after all, have some experience with paternity suits.
Okay, so I am here in Washington, D.C., operating on a mere 2 hours of sleep, and I happen to be here with a fellow literary podcaster, Carolyn Kellogg, also known as Pinky's Paperhouse. Carolyn, how are you doing, and how is BEA so far?
The more caffeine I have, the better it gets.
Yeah, say yes to caffeine. Woohoo! Well, we attended a podcasting panel, and I'll leave my opinion of this, what did you think of this podcasting panel, Carolyn? What were your thoughts on this?
If there hadn't been a man sitting at the end of the row blocking my way, I would have run up to the front of the room, throttled the guy giving the presentation, and taken over and introduced Ed to tell everybody what's what about literary podcasts.
First of all, did you expect podcasting and publishing to be sort of co-opted by, you know, these sort of marketing terms when you came here? Did you prepare yourself for this, or did this exceed your expectation, or what's the general sort of beef here?
Well, honestly, you know, I've always thought of podcasting as a business solution, but I never heard anybody else describe it that way. No, it wasn't that there was a lot of business jargon that bothered me so much. It's that they really didn't focus on the connection between audio and the written word. They didn't talk in any sort of bigger, beautiful way about what makes sense to listen to as opposed to what makes sense to read on paper. And they didn't talk about books. I mean, like, you have a literary podcast where you talk to authors. They didn't talk about books. They talked about, you know, how a TV director narrates something on a podcast. What do I care about TV? I'm at a book conference.
Well, the slogan that they actually offered there was "Think outside the book." So maybe the idea is to think outside the book in order to access something pertaining to the marketing of books, with which to sort of fulfill some sort of, like, you know, the other thing that was very strange, and maybe you can comment upon this, was the whole sort of increase your market share and basically squash competition. Now, they didn't identify how one can get a market share through podcasting, and they also didn't identify the competition. What are your thoughts on this?
I think that when people first went on the web, or when companies first started going on the web, there was a deep misunderstanding about how to communicate on the internet, and a lot of people walking around and telling them, well, you got to be on the internet because it's the next big thing. And this guy literally said podcasting is the next big thing, which is the, you know, never trust anyone who says that because it's just snake oil. Putting something out into the universe only matters if you're connecting with people in a meaningful way. And one of the two guys on the panel talked about trying to create dialogue with listeners and allowing people to ask questions in advance of the authors so that they felt they had some ownership. And I thought that was all valuable. But this other dude was, who literally wrote the book,
Podcasting for Dummies.
Yes, here, let's go ahead, you do it.
Podcasting for Dummies, yeah.
If that man was run over by a city bus, I would be throwing confetti.
Wow. Wow. Well, we actually have sitting down. This guy, in fact, happens to be stalking us. His name, I'm Steve. What was your last name? Oh, I got it wrong, didn't I?
No, Steve Salardino.
Skylight Books, right?
Skylight Books, yes.
Well, you're a bookseller, and we were talking about this podcasting panel where they basically said podcasting is the next big thing, and they used all sort of marketing language. Is podcasting the next big thing? Do you have a stance on podcasting? Are you pro or con, or is there lucre here?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think books are the next big thing, probably. But besides, I think that anything that gives voices to people that don't usually have voices is good with me, you know. So I don't know if there's money to be made, but, you know, as long as if people can put stuff out there and other people can listen to it, and it seems much more anarchistic and democratic and bizarre and fun.
Well, maybe you could also tell us a little bit about Skylight Books and how Skylight Books is anarchist and fun.
Well,
not very anarchist.
Yeah. I like to relate Skylight Books as a bookstore, as an individual bookstore, to the internet or something like maybe podcasting too, where at least it's a place that where voices can be heard that you might not find in other places. I hope that we carry books that are different, or at least a variety of things that maybe you wouldn't be able to find at your regular, or I should say your chain bookstore of some sort.
There was an article in Slate recently. I'm not sure if you read that. The Tyler Cowen, is that the guy's name?
The big buzz about there's a new book out that he was ostensibly reviewing about independent bookstores and their role, and he was very skeptical.
What was his? I didn't read it. What was his take?
His take was you could more easily find a book of Arabic poetry at Barnes & Noble than you could at your local independent bookstore.
Yeah, but can you find a book on fisting, you know, at Barnes & Noble?
See, that's a great counter-argument, because fisting, it's all about the fisting in the end. It serves as a nice metaphor, and this explicit use of the word and the concept is absolutely apropos for the books and the great sort of literary tomes of our time.
Can I find a book on fisting at Skylight?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I've never looked for a book on fisting at Skylight.
Exactly. We have books that you wouldn't want to look for.
So, anyway, if there's a moral to this conversation, it's that Skylight Books has books on fisting. And Carolyn wants to throw men who have Podcasting for Dummies books into the street. And I should probably talk to people with a microphone when I've had more sleep. I think these are the three valuable lessons. Any final thoughts from the peanut gallery?
Well, I think that the interesting thing about podcasting is it provides a way for people to connect with authors and writing in books in a way that's different than they usually do or typically have done. And my biggest problem with the panel was that this little seminar didn't really actually care about books. It cared about market share. And so all of those interesting, fun, and things that people love about reading and about people who write and writing, those things were all left out of this equation for the most part.
But at the same time, one can counter-argue and say that the publishing industry is a business that must, you know, make money in order to justify its existence. Is there a sort of, you know, avenue, perhaps through podcasting or through books? Maybe we have a book seller and a podcaster here. A sort of legitimate or ethical kind of outlet to sort of, you know, maintain such a sort of, I guess, necessary capitalistic existence, or...
I don't think that, just like Hollywood, I don't think books exist without people who love to write them and people who love to read them. And movies only make money when people love to go watch them. So when you can't have the business without the thing that you're selling. You can't have the delivery system without the content.
Is this more of a chicken and the egg argument, Steve? Or?
I'm not quite sure, to tell you the truth. I mean... Books, I mean, I think like podcasts, use a lot of an individual's imagination and or like radio for that matter. I mean, anything where you're not given the whole story all the way, where you have to at least use part of your brain to make up something, it seems to be a much more relevant tool and something that we should definitely hold on to.
Well, Steve, Carolyn, thank you so much.
Automatic doors. Hands waving me.
Okay, so I am about to go into the Chris Anderson panel, and I am here with Megan Sullivan, who runs Book Dwarf as well as a lovely bookstore. Yeah, maybe you can tell us about this and how book... Harvard Bookstore. I knew it, but I just was 2 hours asleep. What can I say? Well, how are you enjoying Book Expo so far?
So far, it's been great. I'm sort of losing my voice a little bit due to the allergies, but I got to say, they've got sunshine down here, and we haven't seen the sun in about 9 days. So far, it's been excellent.
Have you seen any panels yet?
Yes, I went to a Getting the Most Out of Your Website panel, and it was pretty informative for a bookstore trying to expand and market their website, so it was pretty good.
Was it really? I mean, I went to a podcast panel this morning, and it was extremely dubious what they were actually offering. Are you sure they weren't just sort of saying the same old kind of thing? Get listed on Google.
From what I understand, that from like other people who've been attending these things for a long time, like the panels are really hit or miss. Like sometimes you go and they've got like great information, but sometimes you go and it's just like not worth your time, and it's like a bunch of crap that, you know, it's like ABCs of whatever the topic is, not something that we want to go to. So I happen to pick a decent one at least, and I learned maybe two things. That's pretty good, right? Well,
so you would say you would actually apply some of the lessons of this panel to the Harvard Bookstore site?
Yeah, I'm hoping to. I hope I'm going to go back and, you know, confab with the rest of the bookstore people and, I don't know, tell them what I learned and see if it works.
And we're not at liberty to discuss these particular suggestions.
It's top secret as of now. But
they had you sign a waiver when you went to the panel?
No, actually, I didn't have to sign a waiver for that panel. But we do have some secret stuff that we can't talk about. But
come on, spill something for us, huh?
Spill something.
Yeah.
I can't even make up something off the top of my head to make up for that, but. I think one thing we want to talk about for our website is just what do people get out of it? You know, like when a person comes to the Harvard Bookstore website, like why are they looking there? As opposed to say Amazon, like what brings them to us versus them, and try to figure out why they're doing that and maybe make it easier for people, make people want to come to our site over other people, which sounds pretty basic, but actually figuring those things out is really difficult. And this seminar gave me a couple tips to try to figure that out. So.
But can a website really sort of hope to compete with the natural kind of environs of a bookstore where one is allowed to kind of sift through books?
Well, one of the interesting things about our website is that we have a lot of people that order online, but then there's an option to go pick up the book in the store. And we get a lot of people who do that, where they browse, they may come in the store and pick up the book later on after they've bought it. So They're customers of our store that are just now accessing our website, and also all of our event information is up there too. So I'm hoping that we'll eventually start getting podcasting onto our website.
I see. You're trying to do that. Well, actually, I should also go over to Amanda, who also works at the Harvard Bookstore. Amanda, how are you enjoying Book Expo, and what have you learned so far?
I've been
enjoyed it so far. We've only been here for a couple of hours, so I don't know if I've had a full experience yet, but I went to a panel this morning about shopping local and forming business communities business alliances in the community, and I'm actually just typing that up right now for Megan's blog.
Then I should not be interviewing you, should I?
I know, I need to get her computer back to her. But it was really helpful, and Stacey Mitchell was the person that I was just sort of writing about, and she has a new book coming out about big box retailers and how they affect local communities and sort of ways that you can combat them in your own community. So I'm pretty excited to learn more about that and to hopefully host her in the fall.
Gotcha. Well, thank you, Amanda, and thank you, Megan. It's Dan Finnegan, the folk hero of HTML. This is the tale of a clever sod. HTML was his gift from God. He slaved all night coding the master site. Never paid a cent. What was his by right? Okay, I am here right before the long tail panel of a number of lit bloggers. We have Ron Hogan, Ron, and Cassia Crozier, and Kirk, her husband. Big Leon. And of course, Megan Sullivan, but we've already interviewed her, so forget her. So anyway, how are you all feeling about BEA, Ron?
So far, so good. It's, you know, saw some good panels this morning. Looking forward to seeing hearing what Chris has to say about the long tail. And then, you know, Sarah will tell me later on what Sam Tannenhaus said at that wacky New York Times Best American Fiction panel.
But isn't the long tail a little bit of a conspiracy theory to some degree? I mean, isn't it sort of like kind of like a, you know, little golden ticket at the end that you find by eating all those Willy Wonka chocolate bars? Or?
Hey, conspiracies are fun, especially when you're on the right end of them.
Okay. Well, what about you, Cassia? Do you think that the long tail is a conspiracy theory? Or?
I think it's your chance at immortality. It is. Oh, you know, once you're in the system, you're in the system forever.
Okay. Well, Kirk, what do you think about this long tail?
I think it's more like a million little aluminum tickets instead of one big gold ticket.
Okay. So we have no real consensus on the whole, except that the long tail can, in fact, be, you know, compared to tickets.
I'm just glad to see that, you know, Wired is actually relevant again. That's, you know, kind of a rarity, so...
Is Wired relevant?
Since it's been online, I don't even. Do they still publish print anymore?
Yeah,
because I only access Wired online all the time. I really work with it constantly, which is kind of weird.
So the moral of the tale is that Wired is good.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Wired is nice and shiny and good.
And aluminum.
And aluminum. The future is aluminum.
Okay, the future is aluminum.
It's getting a little too graduate for me.
A scoop here at BEA.
The future is aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
Sturdy, yep. And flexible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. This has been a very rewarding conversation. Thank you all. Okay. So being a sort of part-time amateur eschatologist, I saw this booth, which is called whoisdeath.com, and there's a giant death figure here. And there's a guy named Brian Murray who has a Who is Death t-shirt. So maybe, Brian, you could tell me about what this is, why you're here, and that sort of thing.
Okay. I'm Brian Murray, and I'm an author of the Death Trilogy, the first one being Heroic Death. And Death is a character in the story, and the idea is to guess who he is in the trilogy.
Okay. Is this inspired by Neil Gaiman's Sandman?
No, I do read comics, but no, it's not. It's just something I came up with, and my wife actually came up with the concept of Who is Death.
And you're hoping to attract a publisher with your booth here?
Yes, we are. That's the whole idea of us coming here, yes.
Have you had any particular interest, or why have you actually approached publishers before this? Or
not really, no. I mean, we come over to America to get married. We've just recently got married, so we're here now trying to promote the book. So it was a second thought to promote the book. We was here to get married to start with.
Well, why are you promoting a book if you don't have a publisher attached to it yet?
Because we're trying to promote the whole idea of the book. I mean, I've self-published this one just so people got an idea of what it is, and it's just trying to get the first step on the ladder, to be honest.
I guess, though, what I'm asking, though, is why did the manuscript of this Heroic Death, I guess the first in the trilogy, did this get rejected by all the publishers, and that's why you self-published it?
No, I've only ever sent it to one publisher in London who's currently reading it, and we've sent the ideas to a couple of literary agents, but we've not done a full-bodied marketing exercise on it yet, so we've not sent it out to everybody yet.
Well, then why did you opt for self-publishing over a publisher?
Because we wanted to promote the whole concept. It's not just the book, Heroic Death, it's the trilogy. And to sell a trilogy, I believe you need a concept as well. So we're trying to sell the concept of Who is Death.
Why do you think a publisher can't necessarily sell this particular trilogy? I mean, you know, if you get a publisher, then they'll be able to sort of like sell the trilogy like that whole, you know, the book of the guy living off the grid last year, you know?
No, that I understand. But I mean, the way that we're trying to do this is that we've come up with what we think is a good marketing campaign. You've seen it. Everyone's just like, who is Death? And it's just the concept that we're trying to sell. And we think that with a publisher, 9 times out of 10, if the story's good, fine. But sometimes you need just a little bit of more of an edge to get in the door. So this is why we've done this.
But do you think the concept will detract from whatever the qualities are of the manuscript? Or
no, I think it will add to the manuscript, to be honest.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay, I am here with Michelle Wilgen. Michelle Wilgen of Tin House. Of course, anyone knowing the literary world knows what Tin House is, but maybe, Michelle, you could tell us what is happening on the Tin House front.
Tin House is a literary quarterly. We have our current international issue out right now, and that's here. We also are in our first year as an independent book press after being part of Tin House Bloomsbury, and now we're just Tin House Books on our own. So we have our first two titles out here, which is Girls in Peril, and this is a Barnes & Noble Emerging Voice that was just chosen, and Best of Tin House, which is a Tin House anthology of fiction, I should say. And then we also have an anthology of food and booze writing, which Tin House is one of the only, that I know of, lit mags that publishes food and drink writing, which I edit, and so we're collecting some of these.
What made you move to sort of an independent press?
Because that way we could just have more control over it, and it was a little fractured going back and forth between our offices, their offices. We have offices in Portland and in New York, so then we had 3 different offices we were working with. So this way it's all under one house. It's a lot easier to control.
By control, what do you mean? Just
production, just figuring out who needs to be doing what, all of the basics, and it was easier for us to find out, to keep all the information in place, you know.
Do you have any cross-promotional efforts for Tin House the quarterly versus Tin House the publishing, or how is that all going to work in?
Yeah, we do. Well, we have sometimes, when we've fallen in love with something that works for the magazine, we'll publish it ahead of time in the magazine. Anthologizing some of our favorite works helps us get into that as well. We also use a lot of the, what's the word I'm looking for, the emails and the contacts that we make through the magazine, which has obviously been around longer, then we can use those as ways to publicize the books. We also have a workshop, and so people find out about the workshop, and then they can come and they find out about everything else that's under the Tin House aegis as well.
Do you think that the literary imprint will sort of interfere with the, you know, the reputation of the Literary Quarterly, or...?
I sure hope not. I mean, it should only... One of the things we're focusing on is new voices, which we do in the magazine as well. And so that's kind of an ideal way to get these younger writers who are just up and coming, and that way we can hopefully snap them up and give them the kind of attention that they may not get at a bigger house. So in that way, it's synergistic. It doesn't take away from it at all.
Well, Michelle, thank you very much.
Nice to meet you.
So I was wandering the Book Expo floor and noticed that there was a stand here with an author playing chess with other authors, apparently. And there are 2 authors playing chess here as we speak. So perhaps author 1 and author 2 might introduce themselves and tell us what the plan here is.
Well, we just thought it's kind of boring walking around all day, so we'd play chess every now and then. And so far, he's a much better chess player than I am, but if I'm lucky...
Yeah, you're getting...
I might be able to get a draw.
Yeah. So well, what's your name?
My name is Mike.
Do you have a last name? Or?
Yeah, it's Webster.
Mike Webster, and you should know your name if you're going to promote this. And who are you, sir?
Joseph Wurtenbach.
Yeah, and you sound pretty intense, and you're really kicking this guy's ass.
Oh, I'm just winning. I believe we're... I believe we're mate.
Correct.
I think
I'm
the game's over.
Check here like that.
Gotcha. Do you have books that you're promoting here?
Promoting Lewis and Clark by Air.
And what is Lewis and Clark by Air?
It's a picture book that shows... the Lewis and Clark Trail by Air and gives excerpts from the writings 200 years ago and shows how much difference there is in some cases and how little difference there is in other cases.
And does chess factor in at all with Lewis and Clark?
No, it's just fun.
Okay, well.
He plays much better than he can. He wanted to lose.
Promoting his book.
This is
got, and there, you have a tuba here too.
Well, it's actually a sousaphone, which is
sousaphone.
A version of a tuba. So yeah.
Got it.
Oh. What are we playing?
So. Tubas. So there's dueling tubas, and do you think that this will detract attention from your book, or?
No, it's just fun.
So you're here mainly for fun, as opposed to promotion, or what's
promotion? But what we're doing, we might as well have fun.
But okay, I got you. Will. You would you like to play a little tuba here? Or?
Yeah, if you'd like.
All right, thanks so much.
There is history in this place. There are dragons to be chased.
Okay, I am here at the Soft Skull booth where there are people shouting and having a lot of fun, it seems. And Richard Nash, I guess they're making up for the absence of Richard Nash, who I understand is getting hitched right now. But maybe you can comment all on what Soft Skull is offering. And we have two authors here. So Laurel Snyder, what do you have here?
I have just recently edited a collection of essays by people who grew up in intermarried Jewish homes, sort of about that experience, and some of them are really gritty and difficult and sad sort of foster care stories, and some of them are very sort of academic and aesthetic, and there's crazy range, but Soft Skull were sort of the people willing to take it on after much sort of debate at the Jewish houses and mainstream presses. So
really, what was the debate in the other houses?
I don't want to name names, but there was some desire for me to kind of go rope in Gwyneth Paltrow and Sarah Jessica Parker, and that wasn't going to happen. I said I want literature, and a lot of people who wanted to see the book finished, and I wasn't willing to ask people to write without a contract in my hand. And Soft Skull was just spectacular about saying, like, sort of giving me carte blanche and letting me go crazy. So
this is a more literary bent that you weren't able to actually get from other publishers.
Yeah, it's much more. I mean, there are books out there sort of in this corner of the world that are kind of funny and poppy and pop culture-y, but I really wanted to tell sort of some fabulous stories by some fabulous writers. I mean, you know, J.D. Salinger was half Jewish and Dorothy Parker was half Jewish. There's this sort of long history of that kind of thing. And I wanted to do something in that vein and not like the Adam Sandler half Jewish song or something, you know? So.
Well, these are all serious essays? There's not a joke to be found in any of these? Or?
Oh, no, some of them are funny. I've got a writer for The Stranger out in Seattle, Anthony Hecht, who's very funny, and Jenny Traeg, who's she's got a book, Devil in the Details. She's very, very funny. I mean, there's some humorous essays, but they're all craft essays. They're all serious writing. Not necessarily serious topics, but serious writing.
Well, let's go back to this literary question. What was the so-called literary label? I mean, how did you define literary, and how did the other publishers define literary, and how did Soft Skull define literary? Maybe we can get into that.
I can't speak for Soft Skull. This is my first book with them. My background's in poetry, and for me, my interest in language is in the language, is in the writing itself, and I think that sort of putting words together carefully and feeling accountable for what you're actually saying, instead of sort of just storytelling, just sort of the idea of language not as content but as language is really, really important to me. And I wanted to be working and editing, and a lot of these are very hands-on editing jobs where I did a lot of cutting and a lot of sort of reorganizing. I needed to be working with authors who took that seriously, and not just we need 2,000 words on this topic, but poems in prose, really serious, sort of, not serious content, but like people who took language seriously.
Well, regardless of whether it was funny or literary or whatnot, it was just the craftsmanship that I guess other publishers may have found threatening as a literary label, or?
Pardon me?
It was the sort of craftsmanship here that other literary publishers that you had, or other publishers had, you had approached me with this whole literary idea, they found this threatening, or?
I don't know if I would say that, but it's certainly true that Soft Skull was willing to give me put me in sort of control and sort of trust my judgment and my aesthetic, and they have been absolutely spectacular in sort of trusting my judgment all along.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Laurel. So also here at the Soft Skull booth is Delia Falconer, who I understand that you are the only original novel that Soft Skull is publishing this year. Is that correct?
Oh, I actually didn't know that, but that's fantastic. Oh. No, I had no idea.
Oh, well, maybe describe your novel and what can we expect from this?
Well, my novel's called The Lost Thoughts of Soldiers, and it's about the Plains Indian Wars, and specifically Little Bighorn, as viewed through the eyes of the men who didn't go to Custer's aid, specifically Captain Frederick Benteen, who was the person who's basically, I feel, sort of saved the rest of the Seventh's lives at Bighorn. But it's my interest isn't really in the minutiae of battle. In fact, I think, you know, our stories of war tend to get sort of flooded under those. What I'm interested in is the idea of how, in any war, we deal with the issue of the lives that are taken, the value of a life, dealing with our actions 20 or so years later. So in my novel, Benteen is at home in his home in Georgia. He's kept very quiet about the battle all his life. He's maintained a certain sort of level of dignity. And he receives a letter from a very callow young boy who works in a bookstore in Chicago as a clerk, who says that he feels that he is the person to restore Benteen's reputation to the world, and he feels that they can work together very well to do this. And Benteen takes a certain perverse pleasure in the idea of, he normally doesn't reply to correspondence, but he takes the great pleasure in the idea of corresponding to someone so callow and such an unworthy correspondent. And so as he starts to think about how to reply to this boy about the meaning of his life and about his role in Little Bighorn, he actually finds that his thoughts keep turning to the small ephemeral moments of life out on the plains and a soldier's life outside. He says he finds himself saying that war is nine-tenths nothing, and it's the nine-tenths nothing, I guess, that this novel's about, as opposed to the 10% battle.
Now, did you find difficulties in terms of an American publisher trying to get this landed, or...?
No, I didn't actually. I mean, I was very glad that Soft Skull came along. I felt they were the most, they embraced it with a great enthusiasm. So I didn't feel that it was a difficult sort of novel to place. And there's been no issue about my being an Australian and writing a novel about America with Soft Skull. They've been terrific.
Now, this was published in Australia how long ago?
Last year, last July.
Oh, thank you very much, Dick.
Thank you.